Session number 27463, Dennis Newman, Reel 3.
Bickford.
So Bickford was the main slow-burning fuse, and I think this had been in use by coal miners for years. And it had a good reputation for reliability, and it was easy to recognize and easy to handle. It's the only thing the student had to learn was that it burned at a centimeter a second. So that if you were going to have anything like a long delay, that was quite a long chunk of Bickford. Bickford was very safe, but its burning rate could be accelerated with pressure. So if someone trod on it, you could get a fast burn in that area. The way that people were taught to use it was to cut off a few inches at the end of a new length and test fire that, reassure yourself that the powder was dry and burnt at the rate you would expect of a centimetre a second. The other fuse that we used was something a fast-burning fuse. I think it was usually known as orange line, and that would give you more or less instantaneous detonation. You could connect an igniter to this line, and you could have, I don't remember the rate of burning, but it was as near instantaneous as makes no odds. But of course the main fuse for connecting explosive was a detonating fuse, which the main one that we used was Cordtex, and again people were taught how to handle it, how to cut the end square, how to put it into a detonator, and how to crimp a detonator onto it. So this was the detonating fuse would be fired by a detonator, and it would fire a detonator. If you wanted to introduce a delay, then you would probably use a dime pencil.
The detonators themselves, were
they? The detonators were about 2 inches long, an aluminium tube, half filled with a high explosive. And in general, we were invited to handle these very carefully, that if they were banged abruptly, you were told there was a risk that they might go off. In general, they were very safe to handle, but they were susceptible to damage by damp. You had to keep them dry, and it required a little skill to ensure that Bickford was the end of a bit of Bickford was cut square, was put gently into the open end of the detonator, and then was sealed in by being crimped with a special pair of pliers called a crimping tool, and possibly then wrapped in an adhesive tape. There were various ways of lighting Bickford. It wasn't all that easy to light. You couldn't just hold a match and the end of it and be sure that it would go. So that they were taught to cut the Bickford with an oblique cut, and to hold a match head onto the powdered filling, and then strike that, and the Bigfoot would then catch.
Right. So you would have been at Arisaig until the beginning of 43?
Yes.
And then you moved out to North Africa?
Right.
Can you recall how you came to travel to North Africa, and really what they had in mind when they took you there, and the journey itself to North Africa?
So we were given a posting with three of us, Edward Renton, myself, I can't remember offhand the third, and we were to go to report to the Massingham mission at Algiers. And so we were given tickets which would enable us to fly there by rail to Scotland, and then by an American flight to Marrakesh that we hadn't heard of before, but was revealed to us was in Morocco, and that it would be quite easy to get from there to Algiers. I don't know, not much to add to that.
And in, so from Algiers, that was, you moved to Tunisia, is that right?
Yes. And they were, had set up a training school at Guelma in Tunisia, and we reported there, and the Brandon mission with a small group of Spaniards was invited to help the American army, who had had a setback at the when they were attacked by the Germans at Kasserine. Brandon had, I think, perhaps a more substantial party in the British Army area, but I didn't have anything to do with them. And we didn't really achieve very much. We had helped the Derbyshire Yeomanry, had a reconnoitering role, and we saw something of them. We saw a little of a Popsky's private army had a patrol in the area, saw something of them. And we did a very small road mining operation to help the Americans, but I don't think it was very effective. But anyhow, Tunis fell, and we discovered that an agent that they thought was operating successfully, in fact, had been captured by the Germans, and his set was run by them. I was able to tell Brooks Richards, who had landed a party on a Tunisian beach and had gone ashore and had chatted with the reception party on the beach, that this had been entirely under German control. So he was very lucky to come away from that.
I was going to ask, how did you become aware that this agent had been turned?
I had learnt that the chances of it being all right were very slim indeed, in that a new wireless operator at Massingham had told the operator that he had missed out his security check, and she thought she was being helpful and would correct the mistake, but of course she was telling the Germans that or should have, in fact, was telling us that he'd been caught. But with all these things, there's a tremendous temptation to hope that it'll be all right and that a mistake hadn't been made. But they believed the operation was still a success and he was asking for deliveries and support. And we went along with it.
Where was the agent actually in Tunisia?
He was in Tunisia. I'm not quite sure where he was, but this.
Were you able to confirm that he'd definitely been turned?
Oh yes. In that, with the fall of Tunis, if he'd been okay, we would have recovered him, but he wasn't there to be recovered.
Just to go back a tiny bit, the Spaniards with whom you worked, where had they come from?
I think they'd probably been thrown out of Spain and were probably in jail in or near Algiers. I didn't have anything to do with their release. Really invited to try and use them, ground operations.
How were they? What were they like to work with?
Oh, they were very keen.
Again, was there a language?
Yes, there was a language problem.
So from there you went to work with the French.
To the French. This was the Bataillon de Choc. They were very keen to get into the war and in fact to be a commando, and the attack on Corsica was in the offing, and the French assets included an enormous submarine called the Casabianca, and we did an exercise off Algiers to show that we could put 100 Bataillon de Choc soldiers into this submarine with a view to landing them in an attack on Corsica. I took part in the rehearsal for that, which was quite interesting. In the ordinary course of events, there wouldn't be many submarines who could have that number of spare soldiers on board. It was a very large boat. And the other British officer attached to the Bataillon, he and I asked if we could stay in the control room of the submarine when she dived, and it was agreed that we could. And the excitement was that the captain, who was a very, very senior French naval officer who could have been an admiral three times over, except he preferred to retain the command of the Casabianca as a captain, and he and his number one had given the command to dive from the conning tower, and this hadn't been appreciated by the rest of the staff because they'd left him outside. And suddenly there was a lot of panic reversal of orders as everything was called off, and a very, very cross naval captain came down because he'd seen there was a good chance he was going to be left outside as the submarine went under. You've probably seen Frenchmen cross, but you've never seen one cross on this guy.
The Casabianca sounds very large indeed.
It was the size of a British destroyer. It was a very large boat.
And do you know what else it was used for by SOE?
No. I wouldn't think it was used much. You know, it would have been so unwieldy and so conspicuous.
So the Bataillon de Choc, you were, again, working as a sabotage explosives instructor. Again, was there a language difficulty there, or a little bit easier?
No, I could... I had enough of the technical vocabulary to be able to get across. But I didn't, as I said, I did a lot for them. I think I gave them a demonstration how to get a large tree down in exactly where they wanted it. The other excitement with them was that they had access to a very antiquated old aeroplane to do some more parachute training. And I was talked into doing a parachute jump from this thing. But I think, imagine I wasn't high on their popularity list, because they put me out over the wireless masts of Massingham.
How were the French actually towards
They were very nice guys, and there were some excellent guys. They weren't as expert as they thought they were, and were loath to admit it. I went into the mess at Massingham one day to have breakfast, and I think it's probably Dodds Parker who asked me whether they were my Frenchmen who were dropping that morning. I said I thought they were. He said, "Well, I think I would tell them to stop because they're being dropped into the sea." They weren't all that expert.
So did you see quite a lot of Massingham?
Yes.
And the individuals there, the
yes.
personalities there. Dodds Parker and Brooks Richards, we mentioned already. Can you remember other individuals with whom you were working?
I think they were the main names, and the Americans had quite a large OSS team there, and they were running their own parachute training. And in fact, I was trained by the Americans there.
Did you volunteer? Was that something that you thought you'd
do? No. Something you needed to do. No, it was quite an impressive setup at Massingham.
Now, as the war moved to Sicily and Italy, your role changed a little, didn't it?
This was joining Malcolm Winter's setup. We were taken to Salerno, and while the Germans were still occupying the town and shelling it when they felt like it, and Malcolm had taken over a little tower perched on a cliff outside Amalfi, and I was given that as a base with a wireless operator and I think we trained maybe a couple of battalions there. And then at the same time, Malcolm had set up a base on Ischia, and I was told to move there.
Who else was there in Ischia?
The chap running it was Eddie Betts, who I think I mentioned to you. It was a large setup, and so we were able to offer a home to anyone, any deserving causes like some commanders who were doing beach reconnaissance. But we trained a handful of Italians there, not many. I did come across
Dennis Newman, Real 4. So from Ischia, you've moved to Monopoly.
Yes.
Again, what were the circumstances of the move?
So, driving across Italy, and clocking in with Holdsworth Works base at Monopoly, and there they had established liaison with the Italian service, who had provided the properties for our training schools. So immediately outside Brindisi, we had two large farms. One was used as the parachute training school, and the other as a battle school, which I took over.
You mentioned before Holdsworth, this was the first time a parachute training school, is this right, correct, a non-RAF
yes.
training school had been set up. What do you recall of the parachute training that went on there?
This was run by a guy called Bill Williams, helped by a splendid Pole called Vordek Burin, and two or three NCOs whose names I could give you.
Oh, I haven't. Sergeant Simmons.
Yes.
Sergeant McDonald.
Right. And there's a splendid corporal whose name escapes me. And so they set up this school, which used a borrowed Italian Savoia Marchetti three-engine transport aircraft, and any aircraft that could be borrowed from either the Americans or the British at Brindisi. So they didn't really have an aircraft of their own, but they had their own parachute storage, their own parachute packing, and they ran a very successful course. And at the end of the campaign, they had successfully dropped 12,500 jumps without killing anyone, which was quite a triumph.
And that was not the success rate that you would find.
No, at that time we believed that the RAF were losing, they had a fatality for every 2,500 drops they did. One of Bill Williams' great cries was that parachute packing had to be done in a very calm and unhurried way. and if anyone didn't feel up to it, they were invited to stop and go outside, have a smoke or relax, anything rather than go on parachute packing, unless they were completely calm and cool and unhurried. The basis of the type of parachute they used was a series of cord ties which would break in a predetermined order, so that as the parachutist jumped out of the aircraft with a static line attached to the aircraft, this would pull the parachute off the man's back and break the first tie, which would pull the parachute out of the bag, and then another tie would break so that the lines unfolded from their stowage in a neat and predetermined way, and then eventually a final break as the canopy was given a chance to develop. So this was it was fairly important that this was done slowly and carefully.
I think you mentioned once before that Bill Williams, on one occasion...
On one occasion, he was keen to join a party that was going to jump that afternoon, and his cocky corporal told him that no, he wouldn't be joining. And why not? Because there isn't a parachute, he said. Oh, we'll soon put that right. And so he packed a chute for himself hurriedly and too hurriedly. And that was the nearest they came to having a fatality, in that this parachute never looked like opening properly. It stayed fairly tightly bound together in what they call Roman candled, with the canopy sticking to itself and not wanting to open. And so he fairly screamed earthwards very fast. But he was a very strong and fit chap. He didn't break anything, but every millimetre of his body was strained in some way, so he could hardly move. And when I saw him the next day, he's in bed and immobile and heavily bandaged round his neck, and I asked him if that was the bit that hurt. No, he explained, it was the only bit that didn't hurt, but they'd told the students that he'd got a sore throat. No, he was very lucky and very skilled. Unfortunately, he was killed by the end of the campaign in an air crash.